Available by mail at olli@uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. Good. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. For many, many years, the world's big oil companies looked with longing on the vast oil reserves around the Caspian Sea. But outsiders, blocked by the Soviet system, couldn't get at it. Then the Soviet Union collapsed, the Cold War ended, and this touched off a new Caspian oil boom, one that would dwarf its 19th century predecessor. This morning on Focus 580, we'll be talking about this latest phase in the struggle for control of the Earth's oil. And our guest is Steve Levine. He is the author of a newly published book that we'll be talking about. The title of his book is The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune on the Caspian Sea. It's published by Random House. It's just been named one of the top 10 business books of 2007 by Business Week magazine and has been getting a lot of positive attention. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about our guest, Steve Levine. He was based in Central Asia and the Caucasus for 11 years, starting just right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and was there through 2003. The Wall Street Journal Bureau for the Eight Nation region. Before that, he covered it for the New York Times. Before that, he worked for Newsweek. He was their Pakistan-based correspondent for both Pakistan and Afghanistan. And before that, he covered the Philippines for Newsday from 1985 until 1988. He also worked on the Wall Street Journal's oil staff through January 2007. Right now, he is working on a book about Russia, and we may indeed get an opportunity here to talk about Russia, but we'll certainly talk about what you can find in the book, The Oil and the Glory. Mr. Levine, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. Maybe the first thing that we should do here is just to do a little geography lesson for people who really aren't familiar with this part of the world that we are talking about. Just give us the basics.
Okay. Shall I start now?
Yes.
Okay. This is a region of eight republics. If you're familiar with the Soviet Union, it's the bottom half of the Soviet Union, and it's surrounded by states that the U.S. regards as of primary strategic importance. Iran to the south, and Afghanistan next to it, China to the east, and Russia to the north. So it's a pretty strategic area, and it's states, since so many people have never heard of them, are called for short the STANs.
Mm-hmm. So Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, the place where the Kyrgyz live, and the Tajiks, these are the places that we're talking about.
Exactly.
And these are all places that were at one time part of the Soviet Union and then became, when the Soviet Union came apart, became independent states.
That's right. At the end of 1991, they became independent.
Although at the same time, I'm sure that Russia considers this still to be within their sphere of dominant influence and are very interested in what goes on there. And of course, as far as the Russians are concerned, they're just as interested as everybody else, the United States and a number of other countries, in having some access to this considerable oil resource that we're talking about.
Well, this is exactly right. This is what the story is all about. That's been going on really for the last 16 or 17 years. It's that these states became independent. It was recognized early on that they had among the world's greatest new energy resources, oil and natural gas, and a lot of countries, the United States, China, Iran, Turkey and others rushed in and wanted a piece of this, except that this was, as you described, traditional Russian imperial territory, and it triggered triggered a conflict among all these countries for influence to control the oil, and that conflict goes until today. And if I might add one thing, mm-hmm. remember that not too long ago, that area of the world was regarded as the evil empire. This was the term that Ronald Reagan used for it, and one of the key challenges has been oil men from around the world were dispatched to that area, what they also thought was the evil empire, and were told to go out there and find an oil field, and this was the triggered the hijinks and the narrative that we're talking about that's been going on for the last decade and a half there.
So how much oil are we talking in terms of an exploitable resource? How much oil is there in this region?
Well, the minimum, a conservative estimate, just looking at the primary big oil fields that are currently either producing or under development, we're talking more than 30 billion barrels of oil. The biggest field is called Kashagan. It's an offshore field in the Caspian Sea near Kazakhstan, and it alone has 13 billion barrels of oil. And just by comparison, the oil industry considers a field of 1 billion barrels to be a giant, and this field has 13 billion barrels. The region, just one more measure to help understand what we're talking about. The region in the next 10 years is going to export between 4 and 5 million barrels of oil per day, and that's the difference on the world market, where prices are set between shortage and surplus.
So this is, obviously, not only is there a considerable resource here, but it's a resource that is just beginning to be tapped and developed.
The world market is tight, and China's and India's thirst for oil is growing fast, mainly for their cars. They're incredibly expanding demand for cars, and as you say, you've got 4.5 million new barrels of oil coming on the market. It's in an area that's not the Middle East, so it's not subject to the same volatility. It's a pro-Western area, and so it's important that it's coming online at this time.
Hmm. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Steve Levine. His book is The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune on the Caspian Sea. The book has just recently been published by Random House. It's out now in the bookstore if you want to take a look at it. Steve Levine was a foreign correspondent for 18 years, posted in the Soviet Union, Pakistan, and the Philippines, and has reported for a number of publications, including The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Financial Times, and Newsweek. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The book starts some ways back, and perhaps just we could jump forward in the story a little bit and to talk about, well, first let's talk about this region when it was part of the Soviet Union. Was it in producing oil at that point, and at what level of production was it?
It was, and this is what makes this story a little bit larger than some of the other parts of the world with oil, and that has made oil men and diplomats think that as they've been conducting their talks and work, that they're really part of history. This is an area where big names we know, like the Nobel family and the Rothschilds family, produced oil. They produced the world's largest supply of oil in 1901. Baku produced 51% of the world's oil. And in the Soviet period, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, the first thing he did, apart from going for the capital, was to go for the Baku oil fields, and Stalin, to forestall that, cemented shut the oil fields. It was producing, Baku was producing most of the Soviet Union's oil at the time, and today historians think that if Hitler had reached those fields and they and captured them before they were cemented shut, there very well could have been a different victor in World War II.
And there were also at the at this time, even before World War II, there were Americans there working in producing oil or working in the oil business there.
Oh, sure. This was at the time that Rockefeller was the king of U.S. oil. He was the biggest oil man around the world, and there at a 30-year oil war erupted in which he went up against the oil men of Baku, and in fact the oil men of Baku beat Rockefeller in the race to capture the East Asian market. And then in the 1920s, when the Bolshevik Revolution really destroyed the economy and destroyed the Baku oil fields, it was an American from New York named Henry Mason Day who came into Baku and revived the oil fields. And an American oilman was responsible for getting Baku and really the Soviet economy at its very outset on its feet.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll go ahead and bring them into the conversation rather than make them wait. The number here, by the way, if you'd like to join in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The first caller's here in Urbana, where we are, and that would be line number one. Hello?
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could talk a little about the influence of China on the Caspian Basin. I think you talk a little bit about that in your book and on your website. I'd also recently seen an article by a professor out of the Army War College, Stephen Blank, and he's talking about all the pipeline plans that China is planning on having run through, for example, Pakistan, maybe even reactivating the old Unocal line. And even more startling conclusion is maybe even somehow tying into the Iranian oil fields ultimately. But I was just wondering if you'd heard any information like that, or just what your opinion was.
Thanks for that for that question, because you raise, you know, who is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and that's China and its thirsty economy. China does have plans to build a extremely long, 5,000-kilometer-long, $26 billion natural gas pipeline to Turkmenistan. Turkmenistan has the fourth-largest natural gas reserves in the world, and China is planning this pipeline. What we're talking about here is that currently Russia has a monopoly on the purchase of Central Asia's natural gas. All the pipelines coming out of Turkmenistan and out of Kazakhstan run through Russia, and Russia uses this leverage to control the price. In other words, keep it down and then sell that gas on to Europe at a huge markup. And the U.S. In this struggle for control of those resources, has proposed its own natural gas pipeline to give these countries an alternative market. Well, China has come in, as I just said, with its own proposal for this $26 billion line. Now, this is unstated, but in effect, if China does build that line, it will be an ally of the West, because the aim here is simply to provide these countries an alternative market And so the United States quietly, in fact, supports China's efforts.
What do you think about the theory that they may also be trying to put together an overland pipeline to bring oil out of Iran?
Well, this is something that's discussed. There are a couple of these proposals on the table. India has a similar proposal. I think that at the moment these discussions coming through Iran or coming through Afghanistan and then on into Pakistan and into India or straight north into China, they're even more grandiose than this recommended pipeline to Turkmenistan. They on paper look very compelling and intriguing, but how do you navigate the politics of, the Taliban in Afghanistan, the hatred between India and Pakistan? I think we're a long way off for any line like that to work.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Okay. Thank you for the call. And we will go next to another caller, and that would be someone who is in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Thank you. Good morning. Mm-hmm. My question is sort of related to your previous caller, isn't it? But looking to the west, say, and I was wondering if you knew approximately what percentage of oil was now goes through the Black Sea, through the Black Sea and then through by Istanbul, the straits there, and that way. And then what the status of any of the pipelines there might be building through Turkey or, and this is a wild one, do you have any information that they might be trying a pipeline across the Balkans? And then I'd just like to listen to your answer, and then I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay.
What the caller is referring to is something that I've been calling on my website the pipeline war. And this is the United States discovered during the 1990s, the Clinton administration discovered that possession of oil and natural gas is one thing. It's great. You can build up your bank account, especially with $90 oil. But that if someone controls your way to the market, your way to the sea, your oil and natural gas is worth nothing. And so, what does that mean? It means that control over pipelines are ultimately the instrument of power, the instrument of influence. It's the equivalent of the 200-year-long or so struggle for control of the sea lanes of the world's sea lanes. And so, pipeline war started during the 1990s, and the U.S. backed the construction of a 1,000-mile oil pipeline from Baku on the Caspian Sea through Turkey, avoiding Russia, and it was built, and it put a big dent. It punctured Russia's monopoly over the oil market, and it reduced Russia's control over that region. It came online, as I say, last year, and it's now pumping about 1 million barrels a day. But what happened out of that is that Russia learned the lesson of that, and it's taking this lesson by proposing and starting to build a series of other pipelines from Russia into Europe, and they are far ahead in a new contest between the West, between the U.S. and Europe on one side, and Russia on the other, to control the flow of oil out of the Caspian Sea. The caller mentions the Balkans. One of the routes are through the Balkans. Another route is through Turkey, and from Turkey on into Europe. And it's very, very detailed. It's very interesting. And as I blogged today, the U.S.'s approach so far is amateurish, Russia's is much more shrewd. The U.S. is about to appoint a very senior diplomat, Thomas Pickering, to spearhead its effort and hopes to catch up.
Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. We're close to the midpoint here. Again, our guest is Steve Levine. And if you go looking for his book, by the way, his name is spelled L-E-V-I-N-E. The book is The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune on the Caspian Sea. The book has just recently been published. It's Random House out there in the bookstores. I'm sure that you can find it. Our guest was based in Central Asia and the Caucasus for 11 years, starting just 2 weeks after the Soviet collapse and up through 2000. He is reported for the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Newsweek, and also Newsday, and has reported from this region as well as Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the Philippines. And questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Before the Soviet Union collapsed, in this region, we did have governments, in a sense, for each of the republics. They had a very strong central government and controlled the politics within their republic to the extent that they could. And so here, when the Soviet Union came apart, we had these republics that now had a newfound independence and at the same time this resource that they could exploit for their own welfare as well. What did it mean to these emerging independent nations that they had under their soil this incredible resource?
That's such a good question, because it's a dimension of the story that I just love. Because, you know, we tend to focus on the American oil men and the American diplomats and so forth. But a big part of the story is just the one you just raised, and that was this heady, exhilarating feeling that the Kazakhs, the Azeris, the Turkmen and so forth felt when suddenly and terrified they were when suddenly they had this independence. And how do we be a country? What, you know, what do we do? And we have these rapacious Westerners from what they regarded as the evil empire as well on their doorstep, scampering for their treasure, and they were sure that they were out to steal the shirts from their backs, and I don't think they were far off the mark. And the oilmen, though, proceeded as part of their deal making to educate the Kazakhs and the Azeris and so forth, and they did things like bring them out to the United States, take them to Disneyland, to on boats on the San Francisco Bay, to Chicago, to New Orleans, to see offshore rigs and platforms. And one of the former prime ministers of Kazakhstan told me how grateful he was and his group was in 1990 when Chevron took them to Disneyland, and they felt like children going around this land that they couldn't believe what was before their eyes, and how going in New York into a martini bar, ordering a martini and not believing that you could have it with an olive or an onion or shaken or stirred or all of these things were part of getting up to speed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm sure that also in these places, after all, these were places that had at one point been part of the Union of Socialist Soviet Republics, but they were indeed many potentates that were ruled very tightly by small groups of individuals, and that it must, for these people, it must have been again, a very heady experience, knowing that now they were free of the pressure that came from the old Soviet Union, and now they truly did, not only truly were they running their own states, and I'm sure that many of these leaders considered them to be their own personal states, but now that they had this incredible source of wealth that they could spend at their own discretion and spent it to, in a sense, to glorify themselves.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, alongside the poverty in which they began, remember the oil price on which they relied, the financial lifeline from Moscow collapsed, and so they really started out poor. But the first deals that were made, whether it was for oil or metals or agriculture, whatever, all included a side deal in which the pockets of the presidents and prime ministers and other ministers and bureaucrats were lined. And just to put a to really focus this and make it clear, this period ends the end of the 1990s and the beginning of the 2000s, meaning the period of the first oil deals, ends with the presidents of Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan being named unindicted co-conspirators in U.S. criminal cases. So Heydar Aliyev of Azerbaijan, who's now dead, and Nursultan Nazarbayev, the president of Kazakhstan, who's still in office, both were named in foreign bribery cases in New York, and the Nazarbayev case, in which a New York businessman named James Giffen has been charged in the largest U.S. foreign bribery case in history. Nazarbayev is an unindicted co-conspirator in that case, and it's going to trial next year.
Mm. Well, so for the people, for your average citizen of a place like Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan, did they see any benefit from the oil boom?
Oh yes, the economies of Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan are booming. Kazakhstan has got a relatively large and growing middle class. It's still got a lot of poverty, and the wealth gap is huge. But the middle class is growing. You know, my wife is a Kazakh, and her sister works for a pharmaceutical company in Kazakhstan, and is able to send her daughters to a decent school and so forth. This would have been impossible previously. However, I think that Azerbaijan is in deep trouble because of corruption, and its oil is going to start declining much earlier than Kazakhstan in just a few years, and the wealth has not trickled down there, has not spread as much as Kazakhstan, and I think we're really headed for a period of instability there.
Let's talk with some other callers. We have someone on a cell phone, I believe, on line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I have two brief questions. You may have already addressed those. If you have done so, ignore them. I think there are other resources, natural resources in this area, like coal and gas. Have you considered those? The other thing that I want to ask is that Russia would not let U.S. or the Western countries get hold of the resources that easily. If you look at it, I think they have still a lot of influence in those states. What are your thoughts about those things?
All right. Well, and can you talk about that? We have been talking about oil, and that is a big factor there. But certainly, there is natural gas there as a resource. Are there other things there?
Oh yeah. Oh yes. The the Soviet Union was the was one of the top two or three richest countries in the world in terms of all kinds of natural resources, metals and rare metals, and half of the Soviet Union's metals. I mean, we're talking gold, silver, copper, uranium. These metals were in Kazakhstan. So Kazakhstan is rich not only with oil, it is absolutely replete with metals. And it's so good that this caller mentioned this, because this is originally the main source of this wealth that the president and his associates use to line their pockets. It's these metal deals, and in general, the metals business in Kazakhstan and in Russia are totally corrupt, and they are. This is just so that we're not culturally myopic here. The companies that they're associated with are Western companies involving Americans and Europeans, and these Western companies enable and are part of their conspirators in this metals corruption. And then I think we went into the second question already, involving Russia, and that said Russia remains a huge influence in that region, and is going to remain that way, because it's geography is the first rule of geopolitics. You cannot change your geography. It is the biggest and closest and longest lasting ally of this region, and that's not going to change.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, at the end of the Cold War, people started talking about the fact that we were going from this, at least a bipolar world where we had these two military superpowers, to be a unipolar world where we had only one military superpower. But certainly we know now that that Russia, because of its natural resources, continues to be a very potent player on the world stage, and in fact, people have started to talk about it as being, at the very least, being an energy superpower, because it has considerable resources of oil and gas. So no doubt Russia is not only thinking about exploiting its own resources, but thinking about resources that are close that it could also be involved in developing as well.
Well, you raise your spinning forward the story in a very compelling way. This region, the Caspian region, is the last heyday of big oil. It's another part of the story that the big oil companies are dinosaurs, and they're on their way out in the next couple of decades. But another thing that the Caspian tells us in these last few years is the very change that you're suggesting in how influence is applied and exerted around the world. In a way, the U.S. is fighting the last war. This idea of installing, for example, missile defense in Poland and the Czech Republic, the new way that influence is struggled for and obtained is economic power. Russia, for example, in its part in this, is figuratively starting a march across Europe, not militarily but economically, through these pipelines, through its enormous economic resources, these tens of billions of dollars that it has raised through the sale of $90 oil. And this is something that the U.S. is going to have to contend with in the decades to come. The enormous financial resources of petroleum-rich states like Russia, China, Venezuela, and Saudi Arabia.
Let's talk again with another caller. We have someone in the nearby community of Belgium. This is line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. The topic I'd like to broach here is just related but different. As you were speaking earlier, China is moving an enormous amount of goods throughout the world, both from and to China. And this has caused enormous problems with shipping. I don't know that you're aware of it, but I'm sure you probably are. Shipping throughout the world right now is so overwhelmed. I mean, you go to any seaport and there's ships waiting out in the outside the ports to get in, and there are ships waiting to be loaded, and they're moving at breakneck speed, any large port in the world. A lot of oil is moved by ship. Now, it's not exactly the same ones that we move our grain on or ore or other things like that, but it definitely does affect the rates of shipping throughout the world. Now, I know Kazakhstan and stuff probably doesn't move much with oil by ship, but probably their product does end up on a ship at some point. Would you like to talk about that at all?
Well, I would in a broader way, and that's that one. Just to answer your question, there is a growing shipping industry on the Caspian Sea, shipping Kazakh oil on its way west. So yes, that is taking place. But it's the way I'd like to reply to the caller's question is the whole notion right now in the world of peak oil, and are we reaching a threshold in how much oil and natural gas the world can produce, and therefore a threshold on how much the world economy can possibly grow. A couple of weeks ago, my former newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, ran out a story that talked about plateau oil, that the world's resources themselves are not necessarily limited, but the world's ability, its physical ability to produce that oil is, and that is, it points to the caller's question, and that's, are there enough ships? Is there enough manpower? Is there enough technology and equipment to produce much more than the 85 million barrels a day that we now produce? And in addition to that, are the petroleum-rich countries willing to just keep sucking more and more oil out of their land so that Americans can drive SUVs? I think the most compelling answer to that is no. They are not willing to go much further than they're going right now in production. And second, there's the world technological ability, ships and manpower and so forth, are strained right now to the limits. And this is something that the economy and the industrialized nations are going to have to contend with.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Steve Levine. He was foreign correspondent for 18 years, posted in the Soviet Union, Pakistan, and the Philippines. He reported for The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Financial Times, and Newsweek. He's the author of a recently published book, The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune on the Caspian Sea. It's published by Random House. And also, he does have a website you might want to take a look at, which is oilandglory.com. Questions welcome. We do have some others here ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And our next caller is in Champaign, line number 1. Hello.
Hi. Mr. Levine familiar with a book called The Orientalist that was written by Tom Reese, R-E-I-S-S? It's interesting because the first part of the book deal with the area of Baku, where there was a great deal of oil expansion in the early part of the 20th century, with heavy influence by Jewish people who moved away after the revolution in Russia. That's just a point of interest. My question has to do with the finite and the infinite. That is to say, if you postulate that oil, the now oil-rich Middle East has a finite supply of oil, and the regions of the world you're discussing have a rather infinite supply, is it not possible that the importance of the Middle East could diminish in years to come as there is a combination of a greater reliance on oil from the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, and other places, as well as greater use of non-oil-based fuels in this country? Thank you.
All right. Well, that's an interesting question. What do you think?
Yeah, this is a much discussed question on the internet, and I just love it. This topic. Let me mention first that the Orientalist, the book that the caller mentions, is really a great book, and I admire Tom Rees and the subject of the book, Lev Nussbaum, who grew up in Baku in the early part of the 20th century. He's an really intriguing figure, and I do talk about him and quote him in my own book. It's thanks for mentioning the Orientalist. The resources of the Middle East are not going to be surpassed by another region unless somehow the world decides that it's going to fully exploit the Arctic Sea, which the U.S. Geological Service believes contains 25% of the world's oil and natural gas. But what I do think is going to happen, and this is where we get really futurist, and I think is so interesting, and that's that. If we believe, which I believe, that big oil, the big oil companies, Exxon, Chevron, Shell, BP, and so on, if they're threatened by their inability to find more oil, to get possession of it, because that oil is jealously protected and retained by state-owned oil companies in Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and China, and so forth, then what are these big oil companies going to do over the next decade or two to survive? And this is where I think we really get into futurist questions. It is to their benefit to invent an alternative way of fueling, of locomoting, if I can use that word, the world, an invention and innovation that would make obsolete carbon-based fuels. And there actually is a race on right now between big oil and the high-tech companies in Silicon Valley to create this invention. And just a few days ago, there was news on this. Google has entered this race and announced that it is going to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in attempting to find such a technological innovation.
All right. Again, I want to thank the caller and go to Urbana for another line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm curious about if oil is the all and end all of all these policies. I'm really curious as to what happened after the collapse of the Soviet Union and that we sort of let the whole nuclear thing just go to the highest bidder, and how when it seems that even if it goes oil, that this was like a completely incomprehensible move to me. I'm just wondering if you have any comment on that.
Does the caller mean by nuclear thing nuclear power or nuclear weapons?
Nuclear materials and nuclear scientists that went to the highest bidder, the
She's talking about the issue of proliferation, which is indeed a very serious
Polycon, all that stuff.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Indeed.
Yeah. It's a very good question. The U.S. Did attempt and continues to attempt to control that by financing the conversion of nuclear facilities into civilian use in Russia, in Kazakhstan, and some of the other states. Nuclear and other biological laboratories and facilities as well. But there's a lot of fuel there. There's a lot of material there, and there was a lot of chaos during the 1990s, and even under Putin, continues now, and some of it's gotten out, and I think that the U.S. could do more. The Bush administration for several years was actually conflicted on whether it should continue the Clinton era program to bring these facilities under control and pay the nuclear scientists to keep doing what they're doing and not go work, for example, for a rogue nation. Recently, the administration has decided that it will continue to finance that, but the issue that the caller raises is a continuing one, and it's one that we really have to watch.
Well, we're coming down to the point where we have a couple of minutes left, maybe two, 3 minutes left. And as I mentioned, I mentioned at least one time that right now you're involved in writing a book about Russia. I'd like to take the opportunity to just have you talk a little bit about the recent elections that we have seen, a triumph for Mr. Putin's party. There's been certainly a lot of talk about his political future. Now, according to the Russian Constitution, he can't serve another term as president, but no one expects him, after stepping down from the presidency, to retire to his place in the country and take up fly fishing. I think everyone expects that he's going to, one way or another, he's going to continue to be a dominant force, perhaps the dominant force in Russian politics, either as prime minister, or perhaps he'll find some way, and people have sketched out various kinds of scenarios, that he could sit out for a little while and then come back and be president again. What are your thoughts about where Russian politics stand now, and particularly this issue of how Putin will continue to be involved in Russian politics?
This is a good way to end the conversation, definitely. We're going to see Putin, as you suggest, for a long time. When I've traveled to Moscow this year for this other book, Putin's guys speak in terms of him continuing to run for public office through the year 2028, another 20 years. He's 55 years old right now. He's very young and vigorous. I expect that to happen. I expect Putin, an incredibly shrewd domestic politician, an incredibly cunning and shrewd world politician, disciplined, that he's going to be around for a long time. And among the scenarios, I currently favor the prime minister one, and that's because unlike the presidency, there is no limit on how long one can serve as prime minister. So if one goes along with his men that were talking until 2028, he could serve as prime minister, the Constitution could be changed to create a strong prime ministership, and he could smoothly remain the paramount leader for the rest of his life.
Mm. And that's, I think there's a good point there to be made, that certainly during the time that he has been president, the office of prime minister has not been particularly powerful. But one should certainly expect that he would be in a position now to enlarge the power of the prime minister, it's very likely that whoever then ends up being the next president might be a much more marginal figure.
Yes, yes. That, if this scenario is correct, even if it isn't correct, the next president will be less powerful than Putin. But if the prime minister scenario is correct, it'll be a ceremonial post like the president of Israel, for example,
mm-hmm.
and the prime minister will be the paramount figure, the czar, so to speak.
Yeah. And what now does this say about the continuing relationship, or let us say the importance of the relationship and the potential for conflict between Russia and the United States?
Well, I think there's going to continue to be one. Look at it from a Russian standpoint. Imagine you were Russia. You suffered through a decade and a half of humiliation, of being on your knees economically, all of the chaos, and suddenly you have this very youthful leader, kind of in the Reagan stamp of the mourning in America, mourning in Russia. They're very proud of him, and they like it when he swaggers around the world. And when he advances this pipeline strategy, for example, that I discussed, this is a market strategy. The U.S. as a mantra has lectured Russia: don't use your military, use the market, exert yourself through the market. That's what he's doing. It just so happens that his market strategy is contrary to it's incompatible with U.S. aims.
Yeah.
And so the U.S. is going to be battling him in the market for years to come.
The book is The Oil and the Glory. Our guest is Steve Levine. Mr. Levine, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Institute has now established the Center for Men and Masculinity, aimed at research, clinical services, and education about boys and men. Information at menandmasculinity.com.
Hi, I'm Tom Clark, co-host of Zorba Pastor on Your Health. And I'm teaming up with the good doc, Zorba Pastor, to bring you In the Kitchen for the Holidays.
Tom and I will be sharing wonderful recipes and giving you all you need to know to handle the holiday season.
So join us for In the Kitchen for the Holidays from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 1 and tomorrow morning at 11 on WILL Urbana.
Christmas Eve day is partly sunny. We'll see a high of 32, west winds at 10 to 15 miles an hour with gusts to around 25. It'll be partly cloudy tonight, the low 22, then the Christmas Day forecast, mostly sunny, and a high of 37 degrees, south winds at 10 to 15 miles an hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, the low 25, and then for Wednesday, clouding up and a chance of snow again. The high temperature around 38 degrees. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois.
As 2007 draws to a close, we thank you for supporting WILL. There's still time to make a tax-deductible donation now to ensure the public radio, television, and online service you rely on will continue to thrive in 2008. I'm radio station manager Jay Pierce. Help us reach our December 31st fundraising goal of $920,000. Call 2-